Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me on this very snowy and cold January morning is my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn.
Yes, I think winter has arrived.
Yeah, I think you said that a month ago.
Yeah, well, then it got warm again, didn't it?
I know, it did. I know. And I was gone for most of the warm weather from Iowa. I was in Texas and Florida. And then I come back and it's like blizzard, so.
Yeah.
Maybe I should never have gone away. So, Mom, tell us a little bit about our guest today.
Our guest today is actually edited with another gentleman. This book, which is How Yiddish Changed America and How America Changed Yiddish. And it's a very interesting book because there's all kinds of things in it from different authors and different perspectives, and it's just amazing. And Elon Stavins is one of the authors, and that's one of our, not author, editor, and that's the person we're talking to. My voice is bad because I have this crud that I can't get rid of. Okay, he is a publisher of Restless Books and the Lewis Seberg Professor of Humanities, Latin American and Latino Culture at Amherst College. His books include On Borrowed Words, Spanish Dictionary Days, A Disappearance, and A Critic's Journey, among others. He has edited numerous things, and he is the recipient of numerous awards and honors, including the Guggenheim Fellowship, Chile's Presidential Medal, the International Latino Book Award, and the Jewish Book Award. It's just amazing how they got all these things together, and I'm really impressed by the whole thing. So we're welcoming him today, and welcome to Writers' Voices, sir.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with both of you.
So, Elon, I notice, you know, that you are very well-versed in both Jewish literature and Latin American. So tell us a little bit about your background that gives you expertise in both those areas.
I am a product of a mix of cultures, of a crossroads. I am the descendant of immigrants from Poland in the Ukraine and Russia to Mexico at the very beginning of the 20th century, Eastern European Yiddish-speaking Jews that arrived escaping anti-Semitism, pogroms, and settled in Mexico, and within one or two generations really thrived, where actors and painters and manifested themselves in different cultural ways. I myself reversed my grandparents' journey, becoming an immigrant and moving from Mexico to the United States, where I have lived for over 30 years. And when I was growing up, I had several languages at home because I was the child and grandchild of this immigrant. Yiddish, which is a language that started in Eastern Europe, in Northern Germany in the 13th century, was spoken at home. It was the language of immigration, the same way that it was to the United States by a large portion of immigrants between 1880 and 1930. But we also spoke Spanish we spoke it on the streets and with the Mexican population at large. The encounter of those two languages while I was a child could be a little maddening, not knowing exactly when you use one or when you use the other one. I confess to even have resented the fact that my parents could not make up their minds, giving me two languages instead of one. I was flabbergasted by their need to complicate things. But eventually, as I grew up and took a step back from that environment and became an immigrant myself, adding another language, English, I realized that having more than one language is really an asset, and started to appreciate much more that the dialogue that the two original languages had. And over the years, I became a journalist and an editor and a scholar, a columnist, and I have remained, to the extent that is possible, loyal to my many language loves. I have tried not to give them up or sacrifice them along the way, as it often happens in the life of an immigrant. You have to figure out how to survive, and so you don't have time to open a dictionary or keep learning. But I've been lucky in that sense, and so I've kept close to Yiddish and close to Spanish, and studied the histories and the cultures and the literary manifestations of each of them, and have benefited in terms of happiness as a result, because both of those are incredible traditions, very different from one another, that have nurtured extraordinary writers that have won the Nobel Prize and that have been able to state in a way that the world is presented to them that I think is very unique.
Now, in this compilation, How Yiddish Changed America and How America Changed Yiddish, it is written in English, and some of the entries have a translator named. So obviously they were originally in Yiddish and translated to English, but some of them do not. And does that mean they were written in English but by Yiddish-speaking people?
Exactly. Okay. It is similar to what's happening with Latinos today in the United States or other immigrants. The children of immigrants not always speak the language of their parents. They speak English, in this case, in the United States, but they have a certain nostalgia for the language that the parents had.
And there are, of course, certain words and phrases and sayings that have moved over from Yiddish to English, or from Spanish to English, or were there some that went from Yiddish to Spanish?
Sure. There have been, you know, the immigrants have a very impactful presence wherever they go, in spite of the times in which we live today, that tends to demonize them. Immigrants are hard workers, and they want to integrate, to assimilate, and they are also eager to retain their roots and connect to the places where they come from. And they do so also at the level of language. They enter the new language and they try to learn it as fast as they can, but they live in and they dream in another language, and sometimes those two languages contaminate each other or cross-fertilize each other. And so there are words from Yiddish that have become part of English, and many words of English that have become part of Yiddish, and the same thing with Spanish into English and English into Spanish.
Yeah.
So, Ilan, tell us how this book, you know, where the idea for putting together this book, How Yiddish Changed America and How America Changed Yiddish, where did that, what was the seed for that?
Mm-hmm. The seed was an invitation that I had about a year ago of an institution that is not too far from where I live. I live in Massachusetts in a small town called Amherst, where Emily Dickinson, the 19th century poet, was born and lived. And I am lucky to really be only about five blocks away from her house that is now a museum. And there's an institution nearby called the Yiddish Book Center that was created 40 years ago. Its mission was to rescue books that were being thrown away, literally, I'm not using a metaphor here, by older people who had read those books, but the children and grandchildren of them could no longer read Yiddish, so they couldn't figure out what to do with them. And when they died or when they moved from one place to another, they were throwing them away. And this young man decided that it was a shame, and that he needed to rescue them. And he got what was the equivalent of a U-Haul truck at that time, and went from dumpster to dumpster, literally picking up those Yiddish books and putting them together. And then he got a warehouse in here in Massachusetts and started collecting what ended up being millions of Yiddish books that were being disposed. And that ended up becoming an organization that is now the World Center of Yiddish Culture. People come and study there, open those books. Many of them have been digitized through donations by Steven Spielberg and others. And living close in close proximity, it has been always really extraordinary. I do things there, and I have taught. I have met a lot of people. And they were turning 40, and they said that they wanted to celebrate. They invited me to help them organize the events. And I proposed to them doing a volume that would capture what Yiddish had been in the United States since the arrival of those immigrants at the end of the 19th century. They loved the idea. And in what, it, unlike other books, I had the title in my head from the very beginning. I went to them and said, why don't we do a book called How Yiddish Changed America and How America Changed Yiddish, thinking that, well, they might like the idea, but they won't like the title, and in that case, we'll look for another one. But they said, we love it, and we love the title, and let's go ahead. And then, so it was a matter of now filling up the pages, because now I had exactly a map of what I wanted to do. I wanted to create a kind of a GPS of the poets and the recipes and the cartoons and the opinion pieces and the letters that many immigrants, some of them professional writers, some of them not, had done, a selection that could be for younger people and for people that are not Yiddish speakers or Jewish. And so it came like a thunder in my head, and like a mission or an obligation. And it took about maybe 2 months to collect some of the material. We translated some anew, and then, you know, as is often the case, you need to ask permission and see if the writer is alive, or who inherited, or who's the heir, and if you're going to have enough money to pay for all those permission rights. But it has been a joy. There has been a lot of wonderful energy. The reception has been really extraordinary. And I'm just very happy.
Ilan, do you speak Yiddish now?
I do.
You do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And are there very many people who still speak it on a day-to-day basis in the United States?
Yes, there are. There are probably 300,000 Yiddish speakers in the United States. There are Orthodox Jews in New York, in Miami, in Los Angeles, in many cities that speak Yiddish on a day-to-day basis for their regular routine, going to the market, going to school, cleaning the house, whatever it is. There are also many secular, non-religious Jews that still speak Yiddish and that have passed it on to the next generation. But one of the extraordinary things about Yiddish is that, you know, having been targeted by the Nazis during the Second World War with the speakers, obviously they were not going against Yiddish, they were going against the speakers of Yiddish, and 6 million Jews perished between 1939 and 1945. Yiddish has made a comeback. There's a revival of it. There are festivals of music and culture in many cities in the United States that are connected with Yiddish. There are Yiddish language courses all over the country. There are movies being filmed in Yiddish. There's Yiddish radio. There's really an astonishing, miraculous return of Yiddish. And I think that speaks tons to the way people realize that a language is not only how we talk to one another, a language is really the culture that fosters that language. And that Yiddish is very old. Yiddish is as old as English. It has gone through all sorts of adventures and misadventures, and it's not ready to give up.
Now, most languages seem to be, what do you say, identified with a certain geographic region. Mm-hmm. And is that true with Yiddish? Was it mostly, like you said, I believe you said northern Germany and mm-hmm. you know, Eastern Europe? Or did it spread beyond that very quickly?
One of the characteristics of Yiddish is that unlike any other standardized national language, think of German or French or Italian or Portuguese or Spanish, it doesn't have an address. It doesn't have a home. There is no country where Yiddish is spoken as the single official language. There are Yiddish speakers all over the world, but there's no nation that has a flag and a currency and a national anthem that are all in Yiddish. And that makes it a kind of transient, globe-trotting language. There are very few languages like that survive, because it is often said that in order to endure, a language needs an army and a navy to protect it. And Yiddish hasn't had that ever. And it was said when Isaac Bashevis Zinger, the famous Yiddish writer, won the Nobel Prize in 1978, that maybe that is the reason why there aren't many words for weapons in Yiddish. There's no much need for them. And so there is really not a place where all this is grounded. And that could be seen as a handicap. Again, if you don't have somebody to protect you, you are very vulnerable. On the other hand, you could talk about the restlessness, the spirit of endurance that Yiddish has, that without all that, it is spoken and continues to be written and music made and poetry spread all over the world. And I think that's one of the things that attracts me the most. In many ways, a language like English is a language that is connected with, say, the United States or England or Canada or Australia, and with the histories of those nations that could be sometimes messy and violent. And in the case of Yiddish, there's no connection directly with a nation. There's no colonial past or imperial quests that Yiddish speakers have had. Many Yiddish speakers have been multilingual. They have spoken Yiddish as their first language, but they have also spoken, say, Russian or English, or as in my case, Spanish. That has enabled Yiddish to live, I would say, in a kind of a nationless nation, in the minds of many, in the hearts of many, and it has that quality of the fabulous, of the ethereal, of the magical, that enables it to go on.
What is the relationship between Yiddish and Hebrew?
Mm-hmm. Beautiful question. There, because of the life that Jews have had over more than 2,000 years, outside of what was the Promised Land in Palestine, and before the creation of the State of Israel in 1948, a diasporic life where Jews lived in Italy and they lived in Iraq and they lived in Germany, the Jews were guests of others, and they spoke the language of the place, in Germany, German, in France, French, in Italy, Italian. But they also spoke a kind of minority language that was the way they communicated with one another. And across history, there have been many Jewish languages. Yiddish is the most famous one, but there are about 30 or 40 others, like Judeo-Italian, Judeo-French, Judeo-Persian, this one, Yiddish, is really Judeo-German. It started in Germany, but it became a dialect of German, and then it became an independent language. It was at first a kind of bastardized German that used Hebrew letters. It wasn't written in German letters, but in Hebrew letters. And then over time, it became its own language with its own grammar and its own syntax. But across all those periods in history, there was always one language that the Jews spoke in the many diasporas, in the many chapters that they lived in, that was the sacred language, the one reserved for the Bible and the biblical discussion. That was Hebrew. Hebrew among the Jews is considered to be the language with which humans communicate with God, and God communicates with humans. And so Hebrew is a religious language. And Yiddish is a kind of mundane, world language that is not connected with religious texts. But then in the middle of the 20th century, something dramatic happened in the history of the Jews, and that is that a Jewish state was created, Israel, and that Jewish state had to choose which language it would have. And at the very beginning, they thought that it should be Yiddish. The majority of those who had immigrated to Israel, at that point called Palestine, were Yiddish speakers, and there was a strong push to speak Yiddish as a national language. But then the original Zionists said that, no, this was a return to the biblical times, and that they should speak Hebrew, and that Hebrew was now going to become not a sacred language, a religious language, but a language of day-to-day life. So Hebrew became the language of the State of Israel, and it's also the language of sacred religious texts. And Yiddish remains a language of the outside the State of Israel, of the diaspora, a language that doesn't have a home, doesn't have an address, as I was mentioning. The relationship between the two can sometimes be difficult, complicated, as it often happens in families. There's rivalry, there's envy between them. And in the book, there's even a piece that I think is really wonderful by a woman professor who teaches in Toronto right now, Naomi Seidman, who suggests that Hebrew is very maleish, masculine, and Yiddish is very feminine. And that has to do with the sounds, and it has to do with the trajectory. So the answer to your question is that Yiddish is what Ashkenazi Eastern European Jews spoke and still speak. And Hebrew has undergone all sorts of changes, and now is not only a religious language, but also the language of a state, of a nation.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Ilan Stavins, co-editor with Josh Lambert of How Yiddish Changed America and How America Changed Yiddish.
I was really interested in the variety of writings and things that you put in this volume. I started out, of course, with the first one, and then it's not a book that you can just run through. You have to sit, you have to digest these things as you go, and that's what's so interesting about it. And how did you choose what to put in it? That's what I'm wondering.
Mm-hmm. Very good question. You know, it's a bit like a banquet that you present to guests, where you want to impress them with all sorts of dishes and appetizers and other delicacies that you have, and you know that people are going to come in at different times. Not all are going to be sitting at the table at the same time, so you want to entice them in different ways. And so I made a together with my co-editor Josh Lambert, I made an original selection that was twice the size in terms of length. And then of course one lives in the real world, and we couldn't have made a 1,000 page book, because it becomes very expensive to produce and for readers to get. So we started cutting, and I have done 3 or 4 anthologies in my life as an editor, and I have come to the conclusion that when you edit an anthology, you're really editing 2 anthologies. The anthology with everything that you're going to put in, and the anthology with everything that you're going to leave out. And that you're hoping that the anthology with everything that went in is going to be better than the anthology with everything that is going to be left out. Because you know that readers are going to say, well, but he didn't include this, and he didn't include that. However, he really included this, and he really included that. So I think that what propels me is to try to make a selection that will capture the eyes and the minds and the hearts of different readers, trying to foresee what kinds of readers might come to this book, young and old, well-versed in this topic and absolutely neophytes to it, and hope that the brevity of the pieces, and sometimes a little longer to let them get a little more breath and substance, will capture them. I think a good anthology in the end encourages the reader, as you said, to jump from one place to another. You don't read it from beginning to end. Very few people do that. But to do something else, and that is to get excited and hopefully go to the book where a particular entry is coming from and read other short stories or other poems by that same writer. In that sense, it's kind of like a getaway or like a portal to a whole world, like a little hole in the wall that you are inviting people to use to see what's in the room on the other side.
Well, I think that was that's what happened. That was well done, very well done.
Thank you.
Ilan, could you describe a little bit of the different sections of the book and what the purpose of those various sections is?
Mm-hmm. The book is divided into various parts. In total, there are 6 parts, and those parts are more or less both thematic by theme, and they are chronological. The very first part wants to show people where the immigrants came from and what they said when they first arrived to the United States. What was their first impression of the Statue of Liberty? What did people think of how Americans behaved when they first arrived? What they ate, how they dreamed, how they got organized in unions or in collective groups, what the role of women was, the role of men, so on. So the very first part is that. It's called Politics and Possibility. Then the second part is called the Mother Tongue Remixed, and that is a part that I feel very close to. It's how Yiddish, the Yiddish that those immigrants had upon first exposure to English, how did it react? You know, many immigrants say, and I'll say it myself, that my Spanish, after coming to the United States, did not remain pure. It started to mix a lot of words from English. And at some point, that generated an anxiety. Am I losing my Spanish? Is my Spanish becoming too Americanized? And there was something called Yinglish, which was the mixing of Yiddish and English in songs, in stand-up comedy. And that section tries to explain how words like kosher and mikvah and shmok and so on entered Yiddish, and how many words like dollar and just the word American entered the Yiddish language. Then there's a section called Eat, Enjoy, and Forget that is about how Yiddish food changed, how the cuisine of Eastern European Jews got mixed with Chinese cuisine or with Latino cuisine, how they ate, what they served, the type of dishes. Like, very few people know that when you eat a bagel in the U.S., you're really eating a type of bread that was created by the immigrants in New York, and the word bagel is a Yiddish word. So that goes also for instance, companies like Cisco that were giving recipes to Jewish housewives at the beginning of the 20th century on how to cook their particular dishes with Crisco and other different types of oils and ingredients. Then there's a section called American Commemoration that is about Yiddish writers building their own identity here in the United States. The following section, the fifth, is called Oi, the Children, and it's what happens to the children of those immigrants that start rebelling and they don't want to learn Yiddish and they want to do things on their own. And it really talks about the tension between the generations. And the very last part is called The Other Americas. And that's something that I'm very proud of in terms of the book, being Mexican myself. As you know, the word American has two meanings. It means a citizen of the United States, but it also means a citizen of the Americas, Mexico and Argentina and Cuba and Canada. And Yiddish also lived in those countries. I am a byproduct of that. So that section, The Other Americas, is about how Yiddish evolved in Canada and in Mexico and in Argentina and in Cuba, the different types of encounters that reflected. And so you can see that it goes from a first exposure to varieties of culture and diet, hygiene, and then enters generations that clash, the grandparents, the parents, the children, the ways the language itself is like a thermometer of how the culture of the Yiddish-speaking Eastern European Jews is changing over time along the decade, and then what happens in different parts of this continent, from Canada to the Patagonia.
And then, of course, there's such a wide variety of types of material here, from poetry to fiction, essays, memoirs, songs, cartoons, recipes, excerpts from a play, oral histories. Memoirs, I might have said that already. So, I mean, you don't ever, letters, it's like a treasure trove. It's like diving into, like opening this trunk full of material and just reaching in and pulling something out. And every time you're going to get something different. And it's like a discovery.
I, for some reason, we tend in bookstores and in colleges to separate the types of literature. Like this is fiction, and this is poetry, and this is memoirs, and this is essays. But in the real world, everything is together. And I think anthologies can do that, can show you that in the real world, things are kind of always in juxtaposition. And you can hear a poem on the radio, and then you turn around and there's a cartoon that is telling you something. And then you open a book and you're reading a novel, and you open the newspaper and now there's a letter to the editor complaining about something that, the mayor did. So you're always being exposed to this mix of things. And I think an anthology can be very flexible and elastic in that sense.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. And our guest today is Ilan Stavins, co-editor with Josh Lambert of How Yiddish Changed America and How America Changed Yiddish. Ilan, why don't you read a section from, or a selection from the book?
With much pleasure. I'm going to read the very beginning of an essay called How Does It Feel to Be a Yiddish Writer in America? It was written by Isaac Bashevis Zinger, who, as I mentioned before, is arguably the most famous Yiddish writer ever, not only in the United States. He was born in 1905. 1904 in Poland and immigrated to the United States in 1935 and won the Nobel Prize for his stories and his novels and his children's stories as well in 1978. He died in 1991. He lived most of his life in New York City. His many stories were published in The New Yorker, and he died. He died in New York, but he also lived mostly throughout the end of his life in Miami. This essay was originally published in Yiddish. It's translated into English by the author, Isaac Bashevis-Zinger himself, in a newspaper called Forwards, in English is known as the Jewish Daily Forward, on May 23rd, 1965. I once said that a Yiddish writer is like a ghost who can see but is not seen. Perhaps that is why I like to write ghost stories. The Yiddish writer not only belongs to a minority, but he is a minority within a minority. He is a paradox to his own people. Theoretically, a Yiddish writer is dead. He moves around like one of my phantoms, a corpse who either ignores his own death or is not yet aware of it. When I tell people what my occupation is, I expect them to shrug, and they do. I feel no insult when asked, does Yiddish still exist? Or when I am solemnly informed that I am writing in a dead language. In truth, I have written two dead languages. 40 years ago, the Hebrew I was attempting to write in was considered dead. In Heather, I also studied Aramaic, another dead language. These dead tongues taught me one lesson. When it comes to language, the difference between life and death is negligible. I have witnessed in my lifetime the resurrection of Hebrew. Yiddish, too, has grown almost overnight from a primitive tongue to a language immensely rich in idiom, imagery, and symbol. In my own time, Ukrainian, Belarusian, Lithuanian, Latvian, and many other tongues and dialects in Asia, Africa, and South America have sprung to life. We are living literally in an epoch of the resurrection of languages. The world forgets or pretends to forget that many languages today, which are the pride of those who speak them, were once looked down upon, as Yiddish is at present. They too were called vulgar tongues. In the early Middle Ages, Latin and Greek were the languages of the intellectual, and English, French, German, and Italian were a kind of Yiddish, spoken by peasants. As late as the 19th century, the nobles of Russia and Poland boasted of their children's ignorance of their mother tongues. French was the fashion then, and even though this borrowed tongue failed miserably as a means of literary expression in the countries that had adopted it. Many writers rose to greatness along with the languages that they helped to form. Pushkin, Dante, and Shakespeare did much to help create modern Russian, Italian, and English. Yiddish, although it was already spoken in those times, has been a few hundred years late in awakening. Modern Yiddish is only a few years older than I am. So rapidly have the changes come about that the language of books written in the beginning of the 20th century is already somewhat obsolete. Even today, Yiddish still lacks a standardized spelling. The first Yiddish encyclopedia and a complete Yiddish dictionary are only now in the process of preparation.
And that was Ilan Stavins reading from How Does It Feel to Be a Yiddish Writer in America? And that is a selection from How Yiddish Changed America and How America Changed Yiddish. Now, you have some essays in here as well.
Mm-hmm.
You want to tell us a little bit about those?
Sure. I've been writing in English for maybe 30 years. And I also write in Spanish, and I write in Yiddish, and I write in Hebrew, and I write in Spanglish, which is the mixing of Spanish and English. And throughout the years, I've written essays on some important aspects of Yiddish, like there's an essay in the book about a very famous children's book in the United States called Where the Wild Things Are by Morris Sendak. And very few people know that he himself was the child of Yiddish-speaking Eastern European immigrants, and that many of the images of the monsters that he created for that book, those charming, non-threatening monsters, the wild things, as he calls them in the book, are really his aunts and uncles that used to come to his house. Some of them were survivors of the Holocaust. They looked strange. They made strange gestures. They spoke in a strange language, but he loved them. And he pays tribute to them. And I wrote a little piece on how, you know, in a child's mind, an adult who that child doesn't know might have an impact that lasts in bizarre ways inside the child's mind and then transforms itself to something totally different. And then I also have at the very end of the book a little short reminiscence, a little memoir on growing up speaking Yiddish in Mexico and how strange it was. You know, Mexico today has about 135 million people and only about 30,000 Jews. The majority of Mexicans will never see a Jew in their life and will never hear anything connected with Yiddish. And I felt I felt very isolated growing up, speaking this language, feeling that I wasn't being invited to be part of Mexico as a whole. I was both in Mexico, but not in Mexico. And only later did I realize that, you know, that is something that happens often with minorities that are and aren't fully part of the culture in which they live. So that little essay at the end is about growing up a Yiddish speaker in Mexico.
Mom, what were some of the articles and essays and stories that that spoke to you or that interested you the most?
One of them that was the Messiah, and that was extremely interesting, I thought, because these gentlemen were trying to, I couldn't quite decide, did they have some kind of a, I don't know, what did they do for a living? They had, because they were,
they were
going to have a spitter, and then they decided, no, that wasn't, they would rather have someone pretend to be the Messiah, but the gentleman that they were going to have do that didn't know what they were doing. Which I thought was extremely interesting.
Yeah, that's a piece by Moshe Nadir that was translated by Michael Shapiro. There's a section in the book called Messiah in America, and it speaks, as you well put it, to the longing that many people have of different times, future times, messianic times, connecting it with a particular savior-like figure that will come and help or put things upside down. But in this case, there's a lot of satire and unclear, deliberately unclear elements about what that change might be in the future.
Mm-hmm. So these guys are producers in in Yiddish theater. Is that? Because there's several other actually that was something I was going to bring up was Yiddish theater seemed to have been a very important aspect of Yiddish culture in the early days of the immigration to America.
Yiddish theater was an essential form of entertainment and also of expression of this group. Of this group of immigrants that came to the United States. There was a very lively, vigorous theater scene in New York, at the very beginning of the 20th century that was in Yiddish. And very often there was some of those plays were translated into English and were staged on Broadway. So that is pretty hard today. It was very hard at that time as well. But that shows the quality that the Yiddish theater had at that time. Let us remember, of course, that in the 1910s and the 1920s, there was no other form as widely spread in terms of entertainment as we have today. No television, no cinema, no streaming, no internet. And so theater was really what people longed to see. They would pour into the theaters to see the performances. And one of the pieces in the book is really very important, not only in the history of Yiddish theater, but in the history of American theater. It's called God of Vengeance. Was written by a very famous Yiddish novelist that was also a playwright, Sholem Asch. And it was the very first time on an American stage that there was a kiss between two women. And it was so scandalous at the time, we're talking about the 1910s, that there was a riot outside when the first performance was about to take place. The police came, closed the play, put all the actors and the playwright in prison. And there was a lot of discussion. This was obscenity. This was impure. It was bringing down the moral codes of America. So you see there the connection between what Yiddish theater was doing to America and what America was doing to Yiddish theater as well. Over time, many of the Yiddish-speaking Jews jumped to American theater and performed in English, and then eventually to movies. Walter Matthau, for instance, Leonard Nimoy of Star Trek, were Yiddish speakers. The book includes memoirs by them. There were also others that moved to television. Jerry Seinfeld is one that inherited a lot. Mel Brooks. And so there was a lot of power in Yiddish theater that then permeated other forms of American entertainment through the sensibility of Yiddish.
And this piece that Caroline was talking about from Messiah mm-hmm. in America by Moshe Nadir, is that how you mm-hmm. pronounce? Yeah. So it yeah. reminded me also a little bit of The Producers, the film, you know,
yes.
the Mel Brooks.
The film by Mel Brooks.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, which yeah. is it's irreverential, it's funny, it makes fun of itself. It's impossible to think of Mel Brooks in particular without thinking of the whole tradition. If you know, for those of us who know about it, of the whole tradition of Yiddish theater before the very first movie by Mel Brooks, who made The Producers, had portions in Yiddish. And Mel Brooks talks in interviews about the influence that writers like Moshe Nadir and others had on his parents' generation.
And just a little coincidental connection, Gene Wilder was in The mm-hmm. Producers, and he was he attended the University of Iowa in the theater program there and was in a class with Caroline. Although she doesn't remember him, but another classmate of theirs does remember him being in that class.
Yes, that happens.
Yeah, which was Dan Isaacson, who was became a very close family friend because he introduced my mother and my father to each other.
Mm. Oh, beautiful. Yeah. There is value in what happens in the classroom, huh?
Yeah, yeah. So, Ilan, tell us a little bit about Restless Books.
Yeah. I'm really happy that you asked that, Monica. Restless Books is an independent nonprofit publishing house based in Brooklyn, New York, that I started 6 years ago. Having been an author for many years already then, in every opportunity I had on radio and in newspapers and other media to complain about how little is translated from other languages into English in the United States. In, for instance, in Germany, 60% of the books that are published every year come from other languages and are translated into German. In France, it's 51%. Spain also has a very high percentage. But in the United States, only 3% of all the books that are published every year, it comes from other languages and it's in translation. There's a kind of allergy here. The most powerful country in the world has so little interest in what's happening in other parts of the world and in other cultures, in other languages. So I used to complain all the time when I could that that this country was closing its eyes and ears and heart to the rest of the world. And at one point, already coming close to turning 50, the host of a radio show told me, "You've been saying this, Ilan, for a long time. Isn't it time to change your message or maybe do something about it?" And that message, that statement really left me, impacted me. And I decided that either I tried to do something on my own or that I would try to present it in different ways. But I took the first option and tried to see if I could raise some money and create a publishing house that, however small its impact, would try to change the diet of American readers by talking much more about immigration, talking about bringing translations of books of other cultures. Maybe it was a midlife crisis. I didn't think it was going to go fast, to be honest. I thought maybe after one book or two books, the thing would vanish into thin air. But all these years later, we are publishing 20 books a year. It's a very healthy program. We get books from Iceland, from Russia, from the Arab world, from Latin America. We get grants to translate them into English. We match them with sharp translators. It's always very important to make the connection between a good translator and a book, because there has to be some sort of empathy between the two. And the public has responded just beautifully. The books have sold very well. They are reviewed. They have received, fortunately, many prizes. People like you are interested in it. It seems to me that though the big corporations are always giving us the big shtick of certain types of books, there's a hunger, a genuine, authentic hunger within this country that is so big of trying to hear what's happening in other parts of the world beyond what our politicians and our kind of most salient media tells us. And, you know, 20 books is a lot for a small publisher. We have now 8 people working full time and really passionate, terrific editors and publicists, etc. But how big can your impact be? And yet there's a famous line in the Talmud, which is one of the famous Jewish books, religious books, that says, if you change one person, you are changing the world. Mm-hmm. And so it's a book at a time. Maybe I should say a page at a time or a sentence and a word at a time. But there is a change that I am noticing, and it also, frankly, justifies my days.
Oh. And it seems like you have pretty good distribution.
They are distributed through Simon & Schuster worldwide. So they are, you can buy them in Australia and everywhere where English language books, even in non-English language countries like France, if they have English language bookstores, the books are there. And so that's an interesting partnership. You know, the small publishers depend on the help that the big distributors, I mean, not, we pay for it. Every dollar that comes in because of sales in a book like How Yiddish Changed America, 20 cents of that book go to Simon & Schuster for distribution, for publicity, etc. But those books are being read in London. They are being read in Johannesburg, and that's amazing. And in the age of globalism, books still travel. They don't travel as fast as an email, but people are hungry and they look for different things. And though we all complain that people are reading less and less, I think that literature has always been for a group of passionate readers, and those passionate readers are probably more passionate today than at any time before.
I think you're right. And, you know, I'm glad you called out the fact that so few books in the U.S. are translated. I'm going to watch more for those and try and do more of those on Writer's Voices. I know we did at least two last year. We did A Fist or a Heart, which was an Icelandic book by Kristin Eric's daughter. And we did The Murmur of Bees by Sofia Segovia, who's a very well-known Mexican author.
But
I'm going to keep my eye open for more.
Terrific.
Like that.
Yeah, you see, there's change. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And I salute you for doing this because it's important that that other voices are heard. We might not agree with those voices, but it's important to hear them.
Yes, indeed. Well, we're just about out of time, and it's just been a great pleasure having you with us today, Ilan.
My pleasure. I want to thank you very much. It's wonderful that you've taken the time to open the book and to explore different parts and to engage in dialogue. I really appreciate it. Keep on doing what you're doing. I love the fact that the two of you are doing it. I have done many podcasts and many radio shows, but never with a mother and a daughter, and that is terrific.
Thank you so much. And Mom, do you have some closing words for us?
I do. Now, both of these quotes are from the book. The first one is, "Man plans, God laughs." And the other one is, "The whole world is one town." And I found that to be extremely interesting.
And can you say those in Yiddish for us?
I can't say those because I don't have them. I don't want to falsify them, but I can tell you one that I a Yiddish saying that I really love. It's called "Der Sechel is a Kricher," and it means that understanding grows at a snail's pace.
Well, thank you for being with us, and see you all next week on Writer's Voices.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.